Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So today I am reviewing a classic book. Well, maybe not so much a classic book, but a book that a classic movie was made out of. This is Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton, and it was published in 1990. And I've read this book a few times before, all the way going back to the 90s when Jurassic Park, the movie, came out. I remember having a book. I'm not sure if I bought it or it was just around in the family home, and I read the original book around about the same time that the movie came out, probably just afterwards. I remember the book had the movie logo and the movie kind of graphics on the front. So it was, you know, one of those tie-in republishings or like new editions for the movie. Now a major motion picture, that kind of book. And I really enjoyed the book back then, mainly because I think I really enjoyed the movie. It's still, even to this day, probably one of my favorite kind of action family adventure kind of movies. There's a few movies that when they come on and I just see them on TV or something like that, any time at all, it doesn't matter where they are in the movie, I can just kind of sit down and start watching it. And there's quite a few movies that are like that, but Jurassic Park is certainly one of those early movies like that. And and I was not just obsessed with dinosaurs as a kid. Of course I was, because I was a kid, and all kids are obsessed with dinosaurs, I guess, or at least all boys. I mean, that's what it even says here in the book, you know, all boys are obsessed with dinosaurs. That's what Jurassic Park was made for, you know. It was made for the 12-year-old boy, 13-year-old boy. Turns out I was 13 years old, 12 or 13 years old when Jurassic Park came out, so it was exactly in that spot for me. But I remember, you know, Jurassic Park, that it was actually the book which kind of influenced my view of what the Jurassic Park, like actually what the island was like and how it worked. And I remember when I was a kid, like a teenager, I would even build models of Jurassic Park, and I'd look at the, you know, like read the descriptions in the book. Oh, it was this shape and there was volcanoes down here. Not so much based on like what the movie was, but I would even put like the aviary, the bird thing where they put the pterodactyls or whatever they are, you know, I'd build one of those, and I remember researching the book going, oh, what's it made out of? It's like, it can't be glass. Glass would be too heavy. Oh no, it was made out of mesh. That was what kept them in there. And then when the later movies, or the next two movies came out, Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, and the third one, I think that was just Jurassic Park 3, and they had features, that they had things like scenes that were in the original book, like the little dinosaurs, like the compies, as they're called in the book, they were in the second movie. And also there was a scene with a T-Rex sticking its head into a waterfall, and I was like, oh, I remember saying, oh, that's in the book. And then the aviary with the flying dinosaurs, or whatever you call them, the pterodactyls. Actually, a different species in the book. That's mentioned. Then I was like, oh yes, I remember this stuff from the book as well. So this book, I thought, well, I'll reread it again. Probably read it a few times as a teenager. I thought I'd reread it, and of course, there's a new movie coming out, Jurassic World. Does this book hold up? And it turns out, spoilers for this episode, no, it really doesn't hold up. And I think, you know, as I go back and look at my notes here and what I wrote on Goodreads, although I'm not connected to the internet, so I can't do any further research, for this is just from memory, this book was published in 1990. The movie came out, what, 93? Also written, the screenplay was written by Michael Crichton himself. But that is the definitive version of this story. And so the book is a victim of its own success. Like, everything that's in the book is just done better in the movie. Just everything about it. The story is better. The characters are better. Like, actually what they say is better. The subtlety of everything is just better in the movie. And that doesn't happen very often. Normally, the book remains like the canonical version. It's the version which you go, oh, okay, this was in the movie, but they missed this out of the book. Oh, this was in the movie, but they missed this out of the book. Whereas Jurassic Park, I'm like, oh, this was in the movie, and I'm glad that they missed this out from the book, because this is actually, it brings down the book and stuff. Like, you know, I was just thinking about it, like other classic science fiction, like, you know, taking it back to, you know, 100 and however many years ago with War of the Worlds, there's been lots of different adaptations of War of the Worlds, but you still read War of the Worlds and go, no, actually, there's a lot of stuff here in this original book which never translates to the screen and is actually better in the book. And, you know, the movies or whatever, you know, radio adaptations or anything like that are actually weaker because they miss out these parts of the book. And, you know, Lord of the Rings, you're like, okay, the movies are impressive. Fellowship of the Rings is one of those movies which anytime it's on and any point in the movie, I could just, you know, just watch it from that point through to the end, no problem at all. The other two Lord of the Rings movies, I don't think I've actually ever sat through them since seeing them in the cinema, but the first one is a really amazing movie. But again, the book remains the canonical version. There's never a time when I'm thinking, what is, like, if I was to write a sequel, like, if there was going to be a sequel to the book, which, like, would it be a sequel to the book or would it be a sequel to the movie? And it turns out that Michael Crichton wrote a follow-up novel to Jurassic Park, but he didn't write the follow-up. It's not a follow-up to the book. It's actually a follow-up to the movie. So the characters who die in the book but survive in the movie come back for the second book, for the Lost World book by Michael Crichton himself. So I think this is the thing that really shows that even Michael Crichton, he wrote them, like, because he wrote the movie as well. He wrote the screenplay for the movie. Like, actually, no, even he understands that the better story is the movie, the better characters is the movie. What happens in the movie is just better. And it feels like, and I'm really disappointed actually going back and reading this book. I actually listened to it as an audiobook. And I'm kind of disappointed about how, like, it just doesn't hold up. It's just not very good. There's some parts of it where I'm like, oh, okay, this is good, this is interesting. But again, the movie is such a great, not even a distillation, but like a clarification of what's in the book. And I don't want to say it's a distilled version because it actually expands on so much, which makes the book good and leaves out all that makes it bad. So let's get to the book itself. It opens in Costa Rica and there's a... there's this stuff that happens there. There's someone who gets flown over from an island. Oh, by the way, I'm just going to presume that you know that you've, even if you've not read the book, I presume that everyone has seen the movie. So I'm not going to worry too much about spoilers. Spoilers, there's dinosaurs. And actually, that's what happens with this book. You know, it opens up and there's like this, I was listening to the book and the audio book is what? Actually, let me just look at it here. Oh, it doesn't, it's difficult to see. Yeah, so it's like 15, about a 15... Oh, I want it to stop now. This is audible. Stop. It's like the book is about 15 hours long, and it takes us about 3 hours for anyone to admit out loud that actually the book is about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are mentioned for the first time. Until then, it's like, oh, there's a lizard. What kind of lizard it is? Oh, there's an attack, and it was an animal attack. But what kind of animal could it have been that does this attack? And what's happening over here on this island? And what's this thing going on with DNA? And all these researches going on 3 hours in before they actually mention, like, yes, this is a book about dinosaurs, which... To be honest, when there is a big, like, picture of a dinosaur skeleton on the front and it's called Jurassic Park, again, this is a reason why I think this book is kind of a little bit of a victim of its own success, or the success of the movie, is that it's really difficult to go into this book thinking, ooh, I wonder how it's possible that dinosaurs are made. Ooh, like, nowadays, like, if you just go, oh, it's like Jurassic Park, and everyone goes, all right, dinosaurs like in Jurassic Park. Yeah, dinosaurs like in Jurassic Park. It's like watching Back to the Future and going, well, how does time travel work? And in the movie Back to the Future, they kind of bring down a blackboard and go, okay, if we go back in time from here to here, and this is this different timeline, and now... With Back to the Future, you could just go, oh yeah, as time travel, as in Back to the Future, and everyone goes, oh yeah, as in Back to the Future. Oh, okay, yeah, I get that. You don't actually have to answer any of those questions anymore, which I think is you know, probably slightly problematic for the later Jurassic Park movies, that they didn't have that sense of wonder that, oh, there's dinosaurs. Now, I haven't seen the latest movie, but I think that's the kind of thing. It's like, well, everyone's seen dinosaurs now. Now we've got to make them bigger and badder. And they're trying to do that in the movie and actually in the Jurassic world, like the Jurassic Park itself. So, yeah, it's a kind of a, like a strange thing, but I can't really hold that against the book. The start of the book is actually pretty well written. I'm thinking, oh, this is quite interesting. It opens pretty strong. Opens, like I say, in Costa Rica, and there's these little dinosaurs, which are not in the movie, the compies, as they're called. And they say, oh, no, it's a basilisk lizard, because basilisk lizards run on their rear feet. And I do remember that actually became, after reading this book, that became one of the one of my bucket list animals, an animal that I've always wanted to see in the wild and, you know, take a photograph of, you know. So when a platypus, a wild platypus, I've done that and things, and a rhinoceros in the wild, I've done that, and one of these was the basilisk lizard. And when I went to Costa Rica, one of the things that I was like, right, I want to see a sloth, but I'd seen sloths in the wild down in South America. But yeah, I know that there's these basilisk lizards that run that can run on the water, the Jesus lizards that can run across water, and I want to see one of those. And I did see one, and I took a photo, and I saw one run across some water, and I'm like, yep, tick off my bucket list animals that came from my previous readings of this book. So yeah, opens pretty strong, and then the first half is pretty good. It's kind of like the first, you know, part, like the first third of Jurassic Park. They go there and, you know, or they get together the cast of characters, and there's Grant and Ellie and, you know, Ian Malcolm and Hammond, and then the kids turn up and you're like, right, okay, this is all going well. And then we get that first problem where, oh, Nedry's there as well, and Muldoon, and all these characters that you know from the movie and know from the book. And yeah, they all turn up and stuff starts happening. And I'm like, wow, this is actually there's quite a lot in the book still to go. And then I was realizing, but this is a lot of the book to go. Does that mean they're going to be walking back across the island for the entire rest of the book for this, like, you know, the next 8 or 9 hours of this audiobook? Because I couldn't remember anything else that was like happening in the book, in the book, which wasn't in the movie. I was like, no, this is it. They're going to just walk across the island. And I remember the different things that are not in the movie, like the thing with the T-Rex behind the waterfall, and they go through the, you know, where the pterodactyls are and stuff. And I remember that from the book, and I was like, yeah, I can, now I, and I was just looking at like how much left of the book was. I was like, yeah, I remember why now. They must have taken them out of the movie, because you're like, no, we just don't have time for that. We need to keep things moving on. And there is one extra, like, plot complication, story complication in the book, and that is that the dinosaurs are breeding. Now, in the movie, that's there. Just a tiny minor thing. It's like they find some eggs, and they see these little things, and it's a little, like, these little tracks going away, and it's a little payoff for going, oh, yes, life will find a way. But that there are baby dinosaurs isn't a big thing. Whereas in the book, this is like a major thing, and there's some velociraptors that are on a boat, and they spot the boat heading off back to the mainland. It's like, oh, now Grant and the kids have to get back to the, they have to get back to the visitor center, the control room. They have to get back there to warn the boat to not land, because they've got velociraptors, and they don't want the velociraptors to get ashore and start breeding when they get back ashore. And I'm just thinking, oh, that's now a big part. So they don't just have to make it back to the visitor center without dying because of the T-Rex. They have to make it back to the visitor center to stop the velociraptors doing it. And it's just a bit too much. Surviving in the movie, just all the characters are just having to survive, is enough. So we start this middle section of the book, and it's just boring. It's just long and boring. The kids have to go there. The park is put back together. They round up the dinosaurs and start fixing the fences. And it's just like in the movie, it seems like, okay, the kids and Grant have to get back across, and there's other stuff, there's other crazy stuff happening. But the heart of the movie is like, okay, the park is falling apart, and there's some kids and Grant, and they're out, Lex and Timmy and Grant have to get back across, and that's kind of a big part of the story. And it feels like it's a long and hard and dangerous journey for Grant and the kids, but it's kind of accelerated. Like, they're in the deep forest, and then they're in an open plains, and then they climb over a fence, and then they get there. And you feel that they've been a long way, because you see, like, they're actors, and they get dirtier, and more stuff happens to them. But it's kind of like they see this, and they go there, and they go there, and they, instead of going, oh, and then it becomes night, and then, oh, this happens at this hour of the night, and then this happens at this hour of the night, and then this, it's like, no, they go to sleep, and then they wake up and feed a dinosaur, and then they move on. And so if in the movie, it feels like a long, hard, dangerous, but also in parts quite fun. You know, there's so much actually fun stuff where Timmy goes, there's so much blood, and when they're climbing the fence and all that kind of stuff, is, you know, there's some levity along the way. In the book, it just feels long and boring, because it is long and boring. It just takes a really long time, and so much stuff happens along the way which doesn't progress the plot. Like, the plot is they've got to get back and do this in time, that they've got to get back at this certain time, and that certain time is a long time away. And to make it dramatic, you think, well, of course it's going to happen at the last moment. It's going to be like 10 minutes before the ship, or a few minutes before the ship gets ashore, is when it's going to happen to you. I'm just like, well, this is how long it will take to get back, and they've just got to fill that time, and that's it. It just feels like, okay, and now let's fill the time. Meanwhile, the rest of the story, what's going on, like, with the park, with the guys who are, like back in the control room, trying to get control of the animals and get control of the fences, that is just, it's just not a very good story. It's not a very, well, it's not a satisfying story. Now, sure, it's, I understand that it's like influenced by the chaos theory, Ian Malcolm's, the Malcolm tipping point, all that kind of stuff. I understand that's influencing the story, but it doesn't make it a good story. Because in the movie, you're thinking, okay, the park is a good idea. It's an interesting idea. The execution was a bit flawed, you know, there was a few things that went wrong, but generally the staff were capable, the staff were competent people, and things go bad because Nedry sabotages it and all the fences go down, and then from then on it's just all chaos. It's like, that was the chaos faith, life will find a way, and that's what happens in that way. Whereas in the book, you just read about the park and you're like, this is a really bad idea. Like, they haven't thought it through. The dinosaurs are just escaping all the time. It's really bad. They don't have any weapons. Like, the wrong people are in control. The people who are slightly competent don't have any authority, don't have any power. Everyone else, like I say, is completely incompetent. And then when things go bad, like, I'm not, it's like, well, we don't need chaos theory to explain why this park has gone wrong and things have gone wrong there. And we don't need to have, you know, the breeding dinosaurs isn't what says what's going wrong. And even Nedra's sabotage, you're like, well, that really wasn't even needed. Like, you don't even need that in the book. Like, there was never a part of me when I was reading this book now, when I'm not 14 years old anymore, that I ever thought that this book, like, told, like, a story of a park that would ever work, that would ever be run smoothly, that would ever not be a disaster. As I'm going in, I'm just like, everything here is going to be a disaster. It made me think about, like looking at other stories of it, like, in the real world, where you think, oh, well, this is going to be a disaster. Like, I was reading about the Costa Concordia, which is a cruise ship, which everyone know that hit a rock in the Mediterranean, like flopped on its side and things. And as you read through, it's sort of like, and they get on and there was no safety drill. And I'm like, wait, I work on cruise ships all the time and there's safety drills every time. And they just didn't have a safety drill. It's like, oh yeah, it left too late and they were going to have one the next morning. And I'm like, well, that's a bad idea. And then like who the captain was, well, I was like, that captain I know is already incompetent and he only got there because he was obviously on the inside of this Italian kind of family-run company, and he was a head of security, and then he became a captain. I was like, well, that's wrong. And then literally every step along the way I was reading it, I was like, well, this is going to go wrong, and this is going to go wrong, and it did go wrong all the way along. And sometimes you just think, you know, okay, it really does happen in real life that you read about something, you're like, well, this was flawed right from the start. But it doesn't make an interesting story where the deck is stacked so hard, like, hard against it in the first place. And thankfully in the movie, like I say, that it doesn't undercut itself all that time. It's not like, oh yeah, we get in here and everything's gonna go wrong. In the book, they're like, ah yeah, the raptors are actually really dangerous, they're not in their own thing, they're in this very enclosed place, they're in this pen, we're doing our very best to get in here, you know, do this kind of stuff. Now then in the book, it's like once everything goes wrong, it actually doesn't go wrong, and then they start fixing things up again. They get the power running again, and they put the dinosaurs back, and they round up the T-Rex, and I'm like, wait a second, they just captured the T-Rex again, and it seemed really easy. And yeah, it was. They just shot it with a dart and waited for a while, and then it collapsed in the water, and they're like, right, we can put the T-Rex back where it needs to go. And I'm like, well, the T-Rex is meant to be this, like, this indomitable force of nature, which is just going to be rampaging for the... No, they just get the T-Rex back in order, and that's fine. And they put the fences back together, and they fix the fences, and they clear this up, and they put stuff together. And so, like, In the movie, when things go bad, it's like, right, now things have gone bad, through to the end of the book is just survival. There's never a case of, oh, let's put the park back together again. Everything that they do is like, let's just make it so we're going to survive. Like, we need to turn the locks back on because we don't want to die. We need to want to turn the fences on because we don't want to die. We want to do this because we don't want to immediately die. And in the book, they actually do a pretty good job of getting back things back together again. And then it's like, oh, Ian Malcolm is doing these like long things. Oh no, everything's going to go wrong. It's when it gets stable again is when the chaotic system is going to look like it's going to fall apart again. And then it does, but it doesn't fall apart because of like any like thing where you go, oh, that was a really unforeseen thing. No, just pure incompetence. Just people are really, really stupid. The incompetent people who put together the park continue to be incompetent, and then everything falls apart again. And I'm like, well, once again, slightly unsatisfying story development there, where everything could have gone okay, but a guy just forgot something. I'm like, do you not have checklists? Do you not have anybody there who knows anything that's going on? Like, why is it? It's like, oh yes, we'll just let the computers run everything, but now the computer person has died. And it's like, well, great, that was it, that was your backup, is like the computers will take care of it, and if they go wrong, well, that's it. And it's like, again, it was just everything seems to be stacked against it. So all of the story comes down to stupidity and incompetence in a way that the movie kind of like skirts around. It's like, okay, Nedry, sure, like the guy was, he was the bad guy. He was the linchpin. That was the key to the whole situation. And he goes off and dies, and then of course everything falls apart, but it's kind of all from that one thing. Whereas here it's like everything falls apart, and then everything falls apart again because of other stupidity, and then everything falls apart again because this other bit of stupidity. And then this, at one point they're going, oh, let's count the dinosaurs, and it's like, yep, we got all 268 dinosaurs. And they're like, well, how about we ask the computer if it can see more dinosaurs? And it's like, oh yeah, well, we just thought there was only 264 dinosaurs, so once it finds all those dinosaurs, then it stops counting. And they go, well, search for 300. It's like, oh shit, we found 298 dinosaurs. There's lots more dinosaurs out there than we thought. And I'm like, oh, for goodness sake, like, how does all that, like, motion sensor kind of stuff fit in the book? That's the thing with the technology as well, and it all plays into this thing. Like, the motion sensors, I can't remember them being in the movie to such an extent that was the way that they keep track of the dinosaurs. It didn't feel like that was keeping track of the dinosaurs and counting the dinosaurs was such a big thing. It just feels like massive plot hole after massive plot hole. The DNA stuff, sure, why not? I mean, maybe not scientifically accurate, whatever. But then, like, the size of the dinosaurs, I never really felt like, even in the movie, like, oh, this park, we've had it here for 5 years, and we've been developing it this way, and all the dinosaurs, actually, they're really big, but they're only 2 years old each, but we've put them, you know, there's been growth hormones, and we've DNA'd them to be really big, and really, you know, to grow fast. And you're like, okay, I'll let that slide, that there's a full-grown brontosaurus here, and a full-grown T-Rex, and they've grown that size in just, you know, 3 years or whatever. But because in the book there's all this thing about breeding dinosaurs, I could never work out, like, okay, the dinosaurs were put out, and then some of the velociraptors escaped, did they? Yeah, okay. And then some of them changed sex, because that's in the movie too. They had frog DNA and they changed sex. Okay, how long did that take? And it's even explained in the book that's sort of like a few month process, right? Okay, even for frogs, I'm thinking, well, that's for frogs. Dinosaurs are a lot bigger than frogs, so maybe the sex change process takes a bit longer. Okay, and then there's a generation of babies. Okay, and then there's another generation of, and I'm like, okay, so how big do these babies have to, like, how many generations? Like, the new generations, the babies that are born in the wild, were they also given growth hormones to make them grow a lot faster? And like, everything in the book about the timeline feels like a plot hole. Which is a pity. And in the movie, I could kind of overlook that. You're just like, yeah, okay, these dinosaurs, they're new, but they grow fast. But in the book, because it goes into more details, feels like more plot holes come up as well. And also, to bring it back to the computers, in the book, it's so boring. Now, of course, I didn't remember this from back in the day, because when in the 1990s you're reading about computers in the 1990s, you think, oh, this is actually quite interesting, because nobody had computers. Or if you did, they weren't like Cray supercomputers and mainframes and Unix systems or whatever it is like that. So in the book, I guess when you're first reading about technology, it's probably not too bad. I mean, I do remember reading this one book, which is about the early days of the internet, and there was like a stalker who would do it. And I was reading this book just a few years later, and it's like, and the person sat down at their computer, and then they turned on their TX23N1 modem, and then it made this noise, and then they called through and logged onto this one, and they brought up the password and typed in, and I'm just like, well, I only got 4 pages into that because I don't need a step-by-step guide of what you actually had to do to log onto the internet in 1992, whereas here in this book it's just so boring. Tim sits down at the computer and starts going, okay, and then he saw a list of menus, and the menus said this, with this code, and this code. Now, mate, of course, in the book, I'm sure it was just written out, and it's not being read to me like as an audiobook. An audiobook's being read to you, like text from a screen being read to you as an audiobook, is also always a bit dry. But it just carried on and carried on and carried on. I'm like, this is really tedious. And this goes, oh, and then he went back, and then this person was saying this, and then Lex was annoying and just came, oh, don't press this, and it just went on and on. And I was like, right, now I totally understand why in the movie they're sort of like, they use this, you know, this fly through the Unix, I know this, and there's this visual file system, and they go through and they navigate through, and you're like, okay, this was before Windows 95 came out, and, you know, and people didn't know what file systems looked like, or, you know, that people haven't used file systems before, so flying through a visual file system, sure, no problem. In the movie, it might look a bit, you know, a bit silly, but it's actual drama. They go in and there's actually some timing there. It's like, it feels like it's going to take time to find the solution. It's not just going to be, you're not just going to be watching someone go, oh, menu 3A. That's not it. Let's go back. Menu 4A. No, that's not it. Let's go through. Oh, menu 4B. Is this it? Well, no, let's go into submenu 4AZ. Let's go 4ZI. Is this it? No. Okay, let's go back up to 4AZ 2. No, that's not. And I'm just, oh, so boring. So this is the thing, when you actually get layers of abstraction between like computer technology and the narrative function of that computer technology, that is a good thing. Now, I don't want it just to be like a computer is just a box where plot comes out of it, sort of like, oh, and this needs to happen so you can hack in here and make the story progress in this way. No, that's not satisfying either. But there has to be like a layer of abstraction. You can't just be sitting there reading about someone literally reading menus of the computer. So that's it about the technology, that some notes that I made here as well. Oh yeah, and also in the book, another thing that it gets wrong, the action and drama and suspense, not very good, not very punchy. Of course, dinosaurs attacking is very visual, it feels very visual, but in the book, like, I've read about monster attacks in books before, and it's normally done better than this. Like, the rules are not very well established in the book. In the movie, it's sort of like, okay, the T-Rex only sees by movement, and that's kind of a given rule, and the raptors, I guess their rule is that they're just super predators and they hunt in packs and they ambush each other. You know, it's explained right at the very start with Grant is saying, oh yes, one will be looking at you this way and then the other ones will come out and you. I was thinking, like, in the movie, like, well, how does he know that just from fossils? And you're like, okay, sure, there could be footprints that show a raptor attack. I'll let that one go. No problem at all. In fact, I think there are footprints that show an attack of a, I can't remember what the species of dinosaurs were, but there is actually some tracks that you can see, oh, this dinosaur is walking this way, and there was these animals came in from the side. I'm like, okay, that's fine, I'll let that go in the movie. But it's kind of explained the hunting tactics here, and in the book it's sort of like, it's not quite clear, and it doesn't need to be too clear, but it's just so efficiently done in the movie that when you get to the book, you're just like, well, they don't, it's never, like, does Michael Crichton know how dinosaurs are? Has he actually looked, like, has he worked it out in advance, or is he just writing the action and as it comes out, like the rules of how dinosaurs attacks kind of fall out of it? You know, there's never that kind of, oh, clever girl moment, you know, where, like, the inevitable happens. And in the book, there's two T-Rexes, two Tyrannosaurus Rexes, and you're like, nope, you don't need two, you just need one. And why do you just need one? It's because that's all you need. And in the book, there's like 7 or 8 raptors, and it's like, you know how many you need? 3. That's all you need. All the other ones, they just take too long to attack, and they take too long to die, and then you've got to kill them off in this way and kill them off in that way. No, just reduce it down. You don't need 6 raptors, one to be locked in a fridge, one to be shot in this way, one to be locked down in there, another one to be poisoned over here, another one to be shot over, another one to be poisoned over, you know, it's not needed. It can really have been compressed down. And also in the book, it's it says 15 or 16 types of dinosaur, but it's never listed what those types of dinosaur are. It's always a bit vague. You're never really sure how many are dangerous or how many are not dangerous. It's kind of a plot point in the book that they are unsure, actually, how many species of dinosaurs they ever have in the park at any one time. But it's never really clear. Like, it's never really it doesn't bring enough drama in terms of, you know, storytelling. And in the movie, it's like, right, we have these three predators. We've got these small, fast ones that kill you straight away. We've got this big, lumbering one that, you know, if you move, it might be able to find you, and it's a general threat, a big threat. And we've got this other one over here, which has only got one function in the story, that spits poison at you, and then that's not needed in the story anymore. And it's kind of very efficient in that way. And then, of course, lots of harmless dinosaurs, which are only dangerous if they're running and you get under their path, you know, in their pathway or something like that. Yeah, that's good. What else have I got to say here about it? Oh, some characters. I made a note here. Characters. Again, the movie gets it right. And in the book, 90% of the characters in the book are just flat and boring and or just not needed. It's like, why am I reading like for so long? Why am I hearing this whole backstory of this character? He's a scientist. Like, he's not really needed. And even then, not really needed. So there's not a great efficiency of characters in the book. I guess the movie has a good idea. It's like, oh, there's a storm coming. Let's get everyone off the island. And so we're just left with just a few people. And it's like, great, that's good. And people can die. So, like, for example, Dr. Grant, our main character, Sam Neill in the movie, great character in the movie. He's really interesting. He's got this great, you know, he's quite playful with the kids. I like scaring kids a lot, like right from the start where he's explaining, like, scaring this kid shit list with them, that talking about how the raptors attack, and you know, when they're climbing the fence and he tortures the kids again, like being pretended to be electrocuting things. So an interesting guy, but starts off, obviously, it's like he says he doesn't like kids, but is actually probably okay with kids. You know, he writes his dinosaur books for kids, you know, whereas Tim has his book, you know, so he's got this, oh, I don't like kids kind of exterior. And as the movie goes on, it's only a small kind of thing, you know, a small character arc and stuff. But generally, he's a competent guy and he's got a character arc. Whereas in the book, he's like, well, he starts off and he's great. And it's like, yes, I like kids. Of course I like kids. And then he spends lots of time with kids. And in the end, he's good. And it's like, well, I understand that you're going for like an Indiana Jones type of guy, but that's, you know, it's just not interesting. Like, he doesn't have enough function in the book to kind of prop up that character, which is a pity. What else have I made? And I made a note here. In the movie, the lawyer, first to die. In the book, the blood-sucking lawyer kind of is a bit more heroic and makes it through to the end and survives. And I'm like, wait a second, the lawyer isn't meant to survive, which is fine. I've got no problem with that if they want to pick out other people to die first in the book than in the movie. But it is great that in the book, there's these two characters. There's a lawyer character, and then there's publicity guy, like the marketing guy. What do you call it? Public relations guy. And in the book, it's the public relations guy who dies first, like in the same situation that the lawyer does in the movie, or pretty much in that same situation, the first T-Rex attack on the Toyota Land Cruisers. Yeah, which I guess works. I understand why they made the change for the movie after reading it here in the book. Now, Ian Malcolm, Jeff Goldblum's character in the movie, great. Classic character, you know, kind of made Jeff Goldblum's career for a while. You know, like he came back and played the same character again in Independence Day with even some of the same lines. You know, the must go faster line is in both movies, which is great. And in the book, he is an absolute bore. He is so boring. He goes on these huge long rants. He's totally like anti-science and anti-progress and no, it's all bad and stuff. And it's, I skipped the rants. That I made some notes. I was like, this is so boring. Grant is so boring. I've just got to skip forward. And I was skipping forward 30 seconds, skip, 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 skip. And I was like, okay, the whole rest of the chapter, this last 8 minutes is just Ian Malcolm ranting about how technology and science is flawed and bad and is just leading to bad things and is outdated and we need to move on from science. I was like, oh, boring. And in the movie, again, it's weird to come back to this. It always come back to the movie, but it doesn't feel like Ian Malcolm is kind of like anti-Jurassic Park. He's not like anti-science or anti-technology. It's his calculations of his chaos theory. He's made the calculation. He's like, this system is too complex the Jurassic Park system with the new technology, the new computer systems, the new DNA systems, and putting it all together is too complex, and chaos theory is saying that this is an unstable system, and I'm calculating that it's going to fail. But it's not like he wants it to fail. It's not like he wants to see the end of science and technology, and he doesn't, like, but it's like... Is it in the book, is he more complex? No, he's just more boring. And he gets so much, like, screen time in the book that he kind of takes over at some point. I was like, wow, is this Michael Crichton just saying, oh, actually, you know, technology is really bad and we shouldn't do all this? In the movie, it's so good. It's like, well, you spent so long seeing if you could do something, you never stopped to think, you never stopped to ask yourselves if you should do something. And it's like, yes, that's all we needed. We needed one character to say that one line. That's what we needed. He's a great setup to the idea of the book, that technology can get out of control and a complex system can act chaotically, the butterfly effect and all that kind of stuff. That's great. He has a good function and he's a really interesting and fun character. But in the book, really, really boring. Who else is there? Ellie is in the book, seems to be a long pair of legs that men look at, and it's a bit weird, but I guess that's her function in the book. The kids. Now, in the book, Tim is the older kid, is like 12 years old or whatever, exactly the same as in the movie. Lex is much younger than him in the book, older than him in the movie. As a teenage girl, Lex is not annoying. Maybe slightly annoying, but only, you know, for like at the beginning plot reasons. It's like, oh, she's this person, doesn't know enough about dinosaurs, you know, she's someone that the girls watching the movie can latch onto, and the boys watching the movie can latch onto Tim. You know, there's this interesting thing, you need those kind of things. But as a 6-year-old girl or 7-year-old girl, or however she's old she's meant to be in this book, she is just annoying. And again, not annoying in a way that helps, but just annoying. I wanted her to die. Every time that dinosaurs came along, I was like, I hope Lex dies now because she's too annoying. And I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to feel that way about young, like, small girls in fiction. I'm thinking, no, I want them to survive. I want them to be good. I want them to be interesting. I want them to be... But here, she just, like every time anything happens, it's like, okay, Lex, now, okay, there's a dinosaur coming. Don't say anything and don't move. Otherwise, we all might die. What does she do? She says something and moves. And then the next situation is like, okay, now it's time for you to not say anything and not make any movement, or else we all might die. And guess what? She does the same thing again, doesn't learn. And it's really, really annoying. And then they get into the main control thing, and she's like, Timmy, it's my turn to have the light. It's my turn to have the night vision goggles. It's my turn for this. It's my turn for that. Ah, it's my turn. Oh, now we're trying to save everyone's lives on the computer. Oh, go back, do this, do that, do this. And it's like, Tim found Lex really annoying and tried to block her out. I was like, I'm trying to block her out. She is that annoying for me as well. And why can't small girls be written in ways which are not constantly annoying? I don't find all small girls constantly annoying. Why is it when I'm reading this book? What was the other book? I think it was a Doomsday book. I went on the same rant. It's like, I don't want annoying kids. Let's just have kids that aren't annoying all the time. Or if they're annoying, tell me they're annoying. Don't make it an annoying experience for me to listen to the audiobook of them. Who else? In the book, Muldoon is actually pretty good in the book. He's more fleshed out character, and it kind of makes sense that he's the more fleshed out character because he has a bit more to do in the book than in the movie. Which is fine. There's the I mentioned before. I think is it someone Wu, Kevin Wu? No, I can't remember his name now. And I'm not on the internet because I'm at sea on a cruise ship, and I haven't looked on Wikipedia or anything like that. But the scientist guy is fine, but we get a lot more of his backstory, which isn't really needed. He just seems to be like someone else who's ready to die, and we don't see him die in the movie. I don't think so. Hammond, the old guy, is much more of a sympathetic character because I think the setup in the book is like, oh, he's a visionary and this is actually a good thing. Jurassic Park is a good thing. And it's unfortunate that everything goes wrong, but, you know, you couldn't have seen that happening. It was sabotage and it didn't go entirely right. There was a storm and sabotage and the dinosaurs go, okay, right, fine. But here it's like he's killed off at the end of the book, but not in a way which is like heroic or satisfying anyway. It feels like it's vindictive. It's like Michael Crichton has gone, oh, this guy, he has played with nature and he has to pay. And so he will pay with the most pointless and pathetic and like non-tragic death in the whole book. And I'm like, well, I see what you're going for, but again, feels vindictive. In the same way that Nedry in the book is kind of, there's definitely, it feels like there's an anti-intellectual vibe to this, to the book, which I guess it might be there in the movie because Nedry is obviously like, he's the fat nerd character, but it's because he's the villain in the book, you know, or in the movie. Well, he's not the villain, but he's like the one human who we have to kind of hope dies. No, we're not hoping that anybody else dies in the movie, not even the lawyer. I mean, it's funny that the lawyer dies, but we're not like wanting him to die. Whereas Nedry, when he dies in the movie, you're like, yes, that's it. So I understand the casting of Nedry as being the fat slob nerd, but you know, that's kind of his character that you're kind of expecting there as well. But there are other technical people who are pretty cool, like the scientists are pretty cool guys. And the, you know, and Samuel L. Jackson, he plays, I can't remember his name, but he's like the controller of the park. He does the systems stuff. Pretty cool guy, you know, dies, but it's which is unfortunate, but like, okay, pretty cool guy. And whereas in the book it's like, it feels like everyone who's involved in science, like new technology, is incompetent and pathetic, whereas like the only heroic characters is like the mathematician who seems to rail against the stuff, he wears cool clothes, and Grant, who is like old school scientist, he gets his hands dirty, he's out in the field, you know, he's doing the cool stuff, he's like the Indiana Jones kind of guy, he's out there doing real science with real things. And those characters are kind of heroic, and Muldoon, who goes out and shoots people. But it's a weird one that we get this kind of like the main theme, and I don't mind a me and play gods theme, like, oh, the hubris of man is fine, all that kind of stuff is fine, no problem at all. But it brings me back to something I've said about Michael Crichton before, about the weird twist that he always seems to write in science fiction. People say, like, he's one of those authors, which, is he a science fiction author, or is he like a scientific thriller kind of author? And it's like, yeah, I don't really see him, even though Jurassic Park is clearly science fiction, it always feels like he's writing science fiction from a different angle. Like the classic science fiction like formula is, there is a problem arises via some new science or technology, and a society changes because of it, we see how it plans out, and then if there's a fix, it's generally like a scientific or technical solution is found to address this original problem. That's great. Let me just bring it back to, like, you know, another classic science fiction movie like Star Wars. It starts off, there is a new technological weapon, it changes the political system, you know, this whole thing changes, and then at the end of the book, they, you know, they have to find the plans, which is a technological thing, and they find the plans, they find the weakness, and then they kind of play out what the technological solution is to this original technological problem, scientific problem. And that's, of course, stick a bomb down a pipe and stuff, but it's that kind of classic formula. Okay, there is a new scientific problem, we're going to use science to get out of it. With Michael Crichton, and I've said this before on different podcasts as well, it always feels like it starts off and there's, science is a problem, and the solution within the book is the ladder climbing skills of the humans, which came from, I think, when I read the Andromeda Strain? I can't remember what it is. But yeah, they're in this thing, and it just seems to be, oh, okay, now we've got to get up here, and got to get there, and get to there, and it never feels like a technological solution. It always just feels like, and now the humans have to survive, which can work great as a movie, and I think that's why so many of his books and stories have actually been turned into movies, and into really good movies. Some really bad movies, but generally some good movies about that, because there is actually this, you know, like this overall kind of thriller kind of idea to it. Like the movie, the Jurassic Park movie, is like this adventure, but it's like a thriller, survival, horror, slasher kind of thing going in there as well, which works, because if you're going, right, we're in this situation and now we have to survive, it's like, great, now we have the formula of a disaster movie, and that's what it is. It is a disaster movie. There is a disaster and the humans have to survive. But disaster movies aren't science fiction movies, or they don't have to be. There can be a scientific or a technological disaster at the start, which is what I said about the movie Gravity, which starts off and they're in space, but just because they're in space doesn't make it science fiction. What we have is a classic disaster movie. It's not a real space station, it's not real astronauts, it's not in our real world now, it's like in the future. But that's no more than a Poseidon adventure. The Poseidon wasn't a real cruise ship, but it flipped over, and then it's about the people surviving. And, you know, the Tower Inferno wasn't a real tower, it was like a fictional tower that burnt down, but, you know, the people had to get out and survive. And that's what we had in Jurassic Park. It doesn't matter that it's a science fictional premise, what we actually have in the movie is a clear disaster movie, an adventure movie in that way, but, you know, and with horror things to it, whereas, which is great for a movie, but the book doesn't hold together as a satisfying story because it really is a storytelling mess. Because we get this, like as I mentioned before, we get this thing and things fall apart in the park and then they get things back together and they actually mend things. And you're like, oh, this is great. They're actually getting it back together again. And then it fails again. And the ending of the book is then a complete mess because you're like, well, they could have survived this. You know, help was on the way. Why did they just have to burn everything to the ground at the end? That's the end of your book. It's like, well, there's actually this extra mission because they realize, the humans haven't done very much. All they've done is survived, which it would have been great if the book had been a 12-hour audiobook and not a 15-hour audiobook, or if it had been a 10-hour audiobook, you could get away with it just being a straight kind of survival horror, disaster book kind of story going on. But it's expanded out and the characters aren't given enough to do. So at the end, they're like, we need this extra mission. Extra mission is find Velociraptor nest, locate the nest, go in there, count the eggs so we can track how many dinosaurs are there, just so we can kill all the dinosaurs at the end. You're like, really? So all the humans have survived. Help is on the way. Everything's going to be fine. And then, so what do we have to do now? Oh, okay, count the eggs. So you end up, like, these characters are literally going headfirst into a velociraptor nest. And I'm like, wait a second, weren't you around for the rest of the book? So again, it's like this, is it okay to go into a velociraptor nest where there's, like, adult velociraptors, like, looking after, protecting the eggs? Is that the kind of place that you just want to go into headfirst without any, like, warning? Or what's going on here? Like, the whole idea that all the way through the book that they've been scared of the velociraptors and then with hardly any preparation and for almost no need, like, there seems to be no, like, real need to go into the velociraptor nest. At the end, they just go in there headfirst. I'm like, why would you do that? Like, why are you doing this kind of stuff? And all the time through that, like I say, the rules of engagement with the velociraptors never really seem to be there. Like Ellie at one point is like, I'll be fine out here. I'll just act as bait. I'll just be bait. And people are going, no, come in now. The velociraptors are coming. No, I know what I'm doing. It's like, no, you don't know what you're doing. You're going to die. And in the movie, there's this sense of like, if you don't know what you're doing, you're already dead. If you can't see the velociraptors, you're already dead. It's one of those kind of things like, no, it's like, even if you see the velociraptors, you're probably already dead. And there was that tension there. And here at the end of the book, all of that is just discarded. Like, and now they're going to go into the velociraptor nest for no reason. And it turns out the reason is, kill everything. All the animals have to die. All the dinosaurs have to die. So there's this, like, in the movie, survival was enough, but like I say, the book seems to be this vindictive kind of, like, whoever creates anything that goes against nature has to die. All the people who are there have to die. And the people who survive are the ones who got caught up in it without any reason. And Muldoon, who's the guy whose job it was to kill all the dinosaurs, he survives. You're like, oh, really? The guy who was okay? He's good. Yeah. And all of that kind of stuff is like, I didn't understand it. It was like, yes, now we're just going to napalm the entire island to make sure everything dies. I'm just like, well, that is not, the wonder of, like, wow, we've managed to create dinosaurs, and dinosaurs are dangerous, and we're not going to be able to control them, but dinosaurs intrinsically are amazing, and the science that brought them back is intrinsically amazing, and the whole, like, celebration of what is possible with DNA and stuff is amazing. You know, there's all that kind of stuff where there's, at the end of the movie, there's hope, and they look out, and they see the albatross flying, or whatever they are, and there's that line earlier, it's like, well, we can save extinct animals with DNA, and it's like, yes, that is what this is good for. That is what this technology is good for, that it can be used for good. In this case, it was used for, like, a frivolous thing which, like, it, you know, bit us in the backside, but actually technology can lead to the betterment of science and can lead to better things, which is it seems to be in the book is like this, like, no, it's bad, it's wrong, meat and play gods is always bad. So it was a disappointing end to the book. And yes, kind of felt like the more hopeful Spielberg kind of ideals that were there in the movie, where it's kind of like really hopeful at the end. Sure, it ends with saying, you know, Hammond, I have, John Hammond, I have decided not to endorse your park. And he's like, yep. Yeah, and me neither. I can't remember the exact lines, but you're just like, yep, neither. I don't think this park is a good idea. It's like, yep, neither do I. And they fly away. But there's never a, you know, even with Hammond, you can see the regret that people have died, but there's not kind of like that regret that he ever did it, that he ever worked on it. It still feels like a noble goal to set up Jurassic Park. Still feels like a noble goal by the end of it. A disaster, a complete disaster, but still a noble goal. Whereas at the end of Jurassic Park, the book, it feels like, no, everything must die. So, which leads me to say that this book, unfortunately, one of my favourite movies, the movie way better than the book. It's a 5-star movie, by far. Really, really great movie. Classic, still holds up. Even the special effects still really hold up, except for one or two little puppets. But otherwise, great. The book does not hold up at all. And I would suggest, if you're thinking, hey, maybe I should reread this book, don't. Just listen to this podcast. It's better. Not it's better, but it explains why just watching the movie is better, and everything that happens in the book, which you're going to be disappointed with, I just told you in this podcast. So just really don't bother it. I'm going to give it 2 stars, because there is some good stuff in there. It's not all bad, but it was very unsatisfying. And when it got halfway through the book, after the strong opening section, I was just like, wow, I can't wait for this book to just go faster and move quicker and be less annoying and the characters be more interesting and the story be more satisfying and things like that. Like, it was flawed on every level, which the movie isn't. So, yep, 2-star book. I will, though, do a quick Audible ad, which is, you can go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and there you can sign up for a free trial and get a free audiobook, any one of like 180,000 or 200,000, however many they have these days, different audiobooks that you can listen to. And I would suggest, don't bother with this one, but I would suggest another book that I just finished as well, not a science fiction book, which is why I'll recommend it here. I really enjoyed this one, narrated by Simon Vance, who is a really great audiobook narrator, and I did a podcast with him ages ago, and I said, well, what books have you done a narration for recently that you would recommend? And he recommended Darwin Towers, Darwin, oh, I can't remember the name of the book now, Darwin Incident, can't remember what it is, Darwin Elevator, by Jason M. Hoff, and he says that's a stupid book, which is a lot of fun. And he said another book which is really interesting was called Left for Dead by Nick Ward and Sinead O'Brien, which is about a disastrous yacht race in 1979 where somebody was left for dead, and the book is called Left for Dead, and it tells the story of a guy who was left for dead on a yacht and who had to survive. And yeah, it turns out he didn't die, spoilers, he survived and wrote the book. But it is a very interesting Left for Dead. I'm going to talk about that more probably on the next Reading Envy podcast that I'm on in a few weeks' time. So I would suggest that book. It's about 7 hours long, and it's a lot better book than Jurassic Park. If you want another fun disaster movie style, things go wrong, you know things are going to go wrong, and things go wrong, but how will they survive, and who's going to survive? It's that kind of book. So and it's a bit of a Touching the Void kind of book as well, if you've read that similar kind of story, but at sea rather than up a mountain or in a dinosaur park. So that's it. That's the Audible ad. Go and check it out. Start an Audible trial, audibletrial.com/SFBIP, to help support the podcast and also to get a free audiobook if you've not already. As you can tell, I'm a big fan of audiobooks and listen to a lot of them. So let's finish up there. What else do I have to say? No, that's it. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get, and So that's a good thing. If you want to suggest a book, that's a good way to do it, by email. Also, go to the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com. Become my friend on Goodreads, but sign up for the group. And there's a thread there called Books I Would Like to See Reviewed. And if you suggest a book and other people say, yes, I also think this is a good book for Luke to read, and give some reasons, don't just name the book, give some reasons, I will probably get round to it at some point. Someone said, hey, you should read The First 15 Lives of Harry August. And then somebody else says, yes, I think that is also a good book, I really enjoyed it, you should read it, Luke. And so it is now here on my iPod. I will get to that one next as an audiobook. That's by Claire North, if you're looking for that one. Narrated by Peter Kenny, who is one of my favourite audiobook narrators. He does all the culture books by Ian M. Banks. So that's pretty much the reason why I said it. Actually, someone, the person who said, oh, it was also a great narrator, and I looked up who the narrator was, and I was like, well, that's kind of decided it for me. So you can check that one out. I'm going to be starting that probably this afternoon, now that I've reviewed Jurassic Park and finished the other audiobooks that I'm listening to. So yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. That's cool too. I'm actually, I think, 989 Twitter followers, so I'm just short of 1,000. So if you want to become my 1,000th Twitter follower, I don't say very much on Twitter, you know, a few tweets a week, and I do announce when new podcasts come out and things like that, but I'm not a high volume Twitter person, so it's safe to follow me without me flooding your Twitter feed. So check it out, see if I can get up to 1,000 Twitter followers by the next podcast that I do. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.